Hello, everybody. This is Jean Houston, and I am so enormously happy to have with us today my old friend, Marianne Williamson. First, I'll give you the standard bio, and then I'll tell you what I really know. Marianne Williamson, as you know, is an internationally acclaimed spiritual author and lecturer whose many books have been New York Times bestsellers, which means bestsellers everywhere. A Return to Love is considered a must-read of the emergent spirituality. She is often on television. She's been featured on Oprah, Good Morning America, Charlie Rose, all those folks. She founded Project Angel Food, serving homebound people with AIDS in the Los Angeles area. She co-founded the Peace Alliance. She serves on the board of the directors of Results Organizations. And she has created the Sister Giant Conferences to raise awareness of conscious citizenship, which we'll be talking about also today. We're all very excited about this event. Now, that's the kosher telling. Now, let me tell you what I really know, because Marianne and I have known each other in good times and bad and strange and transing and transformational times since time out of mind. I'd like to say that Marianne has and I have known each other since we were both short. But Marianne is a model for the woman as hero, the hero's journey. She has crossed the great divide of otherness in terms of her life, her passion for the possible, her pushing the membrane of emergence, of standing up heroically and with courage and a kind of enormous creative, emotional, spiritual power. She actually taps into domains and dimensions of ourselves that engender this, what I can only call co-creation with the universe. Marianne is also truly one of the most interesting people I or you will ever meet, because she is on the, you know, Hegel wrote about world historical individuals, people whose particular passion corresponded with the turning of the time. And out in front or behind the scenes, they become the entrepreneurs of progress, the ones who really open up the next stages of human possibility. So I'm welcoming my great friend and personal favorite for the higher hero woman's journey, Marianne Williamson. It's good to have you with us, Marianne.
Well, thank you. That very generous commentary. I want to get it on tape and just play it for myself every night before I go to sleep to make sure my self-confidence remains intact. Thank you.
Well, I could go on for another hour if you want to get through
the
full
tape. And I'll be right back at you.
You know, Albert Einstein once said, you can live your life as if nothing is a miracle, or you can live your life as if everything is a miracle. And the whole nature of the art and science of miracles, of miracle makings, is so very important. I would like you just to comment about life as miracle and miracle making, just to start us off, Marianne. Your thoughts about that?
Well, in A Course in Miracles, it says that a miracle is a shift from fear to love. And when you hold that God is one big thought, as James Jeans, the British physicist, said, it turns out the universe is not one big machine, it is one big thought. So the Course in Miracles says God is an idea. It is the energy of ideation, and it is a constant movement in the direction of love. So In that sense, miracles are natural. They are the order of the natural universe. And when they do not occur in our lives, it's simply because we, with our own thinking, has deflected the miracle by using our consciousness and our mental capacity to move into the regions of fear or lovelessness. So when we are thinking with love, we are literally co-creating with God, and we are inviting into our lives always the next best thing through atonement, through mercy, through compassion, through forgiveness,
yes,
and so forth. When we do not use our mind that way, however, we doom ourselves. We program chaos and despair and the network of possibilities in which love appears to be absent. It's not actually absent. It's kind of like an undeletable file that you have in your computer, But if it's not what you download, then it's not what you see on your screen.
Well, seeing it on the screen, that's so interesting. I have found that miracle seeing is a major step in miracle making. Miracles are the activation and the seeing of more patterns in reality than are normally seen or allowed for in our usual limited ways of looking upon the world. So I'm going to ask you a personal question. How have you expanded your miracle seeing? How have you sort of enhanced the whole sensorium, both inner and outer, as well as your spiritual perception, so that you see and feel and can thus enact with so much more?
Well, you know, what I see is what anybody sees, and that is, and it's not extraordinary, it's actually ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
When
yes.
I'm my better self, when I'm kinder, when I rise to the occasion, when I show up with compassion and generosity of spirit, when I think of other people, when I atone for my own mistakes, when I lighten up, when I forgive other people for their mistakes,
mm-hmm.
my life works better. When I do not, when I withhold forgiveness, when I'm snarky, when I'm bitchy, when I'm angry, when I'm unkind, when I'm withholding, when I do not take personal responsibility, then I experience breakdown. It's the difference between, do I want to live a life of breakthrough and basically a life that works and people are kind to me and I'm kind to them and basically you feel all that good stuff, versus it's constant breakdown, things aren't flowing, people are angry, people are crazy. So in a way, it's important, I think, not to make this some huge concept that has nothing to do with practical application, but rather for us to recognize, oh, it's very practical. How's it working for you? You know, and you
mm-hmm.
see, well, if I'm this way, and I program my mind this way, and I meditate and I pray, and I try to be this kind of person, I try to see myself as an instrument of love, and I dedicate myself to that every day, and if I take responsibility for the times that I don't and try to learn from my mistakes, then you live within a matrix of a possibility that is not only infinite, but is always moving in the direction of a greater good and harmony and peace for yourself and others. And if you don't, you know, in the Course it talks about how you can mismanage your mind, but you cannot diminish its capacity. So there's no such thing as a neutral thought. You know, a lot of times we try to just kind of hang out in neutral,
yeah.
but there is no such thing. So if your mind isn't being used proactively in the service of love, it will be used proactively in the service of pain and suffering and chaos, despair for you and for those around you.
Don't you think that this involves a constancy in acknowledging the highest power, acknowledging that one is part of much more than one thinks one is part of a larger story, part of a larger organism, part of the universe of love and loving, part of, you know, I have several books recently out on quantum physics. It's my personal passion. But part of this quantum field, this field of love and its enormous gifts, longing at the threshold of one's existence to pour its possibilities into your life. I mean, acknowledge that these higher powers, the fact that they are unlocked for you, acknowledge that you're part of an immeasurable creative source whose power is love. Even if one doesn't entirely believe this, one can concentrate on accepting that it is so. And this is an act of acceptance, and it's ultimately an act of loving, the act of acceptance. That, well, one thing, just physiologically, it shifts the brain's remarkable synchronicities as people, resources, events, timing come together in a way that is almost a way of the novel, a novelistic way. Patterns fall into place and ease and beauty, and with sure certainty you discover that your life is advancing the life of the world in little and big ways. What do you think? I mean, you've had that in your life, the little and
absolutely.
The big things.
I think
that's
Well, the constancy to which you refer is a mental discipline, and the word
yes.
disciple and discipline come from the same place.
Yes.
That is what discipleship is. But it's like physical exercise. You have to train your muscles.
Yes.
Because if you're not honing your physical muscles, physical gravity will pull them down. And if you're not training and honing your emotional muscles, your psychological muscles, then emotional and psychological gravity will pull you down. That's why we meditate. You meditate for the same reason you go to the gym. You do your spiritual exercises for the same reason you go to the gym, because you are repudiating the forces of emotional and psychological gravity. So if I meditate in the morning, that's how you ground yourself in that trajectory of constancy. Because otherwise, particularly given the state of the world today, the stress, the fear, and so forth, if you just wake up in the morning and you do not do that spiritual exercise, if you do not meditate, if you're a student of the Course, the workbook of the Course in Miracles, or whatever your practice is, then it is very reasonable to assume that you will be at the effect of the craziness and the fear of the world. Then you won't know why you're depressed. Then, like so many people these days, rushing for the antidepressants and so forth, the anti-anxiety medication, because the entire worldview that dominates our planet is anxiety-producing, because it is fear. And that's why the spiritual journey is the dismantling of that thought system and the substitution of a thought system based on love. But like you were just saying, this takes work. It takes work the way going to the physical gym takes work. You know, if you do it, it actually feels good to do it, and it doesn't feel good not to do it. So when you ask me about my own life, you know, when I do this stuff, it works. You know, when I don't do it, it doesn't. My life works really well when I practice what I preach. But if I either get up in the morning and don't do the prayer work, don't do the meditation, allow myself to get triggered in whatever childhood wound is and act out of my fear and craziness, then I experience the pain of it. I think you get to the point, I know I have, where you do this because you know how dangerous your mind is when you don't do it. You know, I've suffered enough, and I've come to realize that the primary cause of my suffering has been myself. And that's what adults come to realize. You know, it might have been your stuff might have been caused by childhood influences, but they are yours now. And so I'm not a perfect enlightened master, but I know enough to know that it is the ultimate in self-care to make sure I meditate and do my best to atone for my mistakes and forgive other people for theirs.
But this also requires, doesn't it, Marianne, an aspect of what we call loving service, or what Thich Nhat Hanh calls mindfulness, so that we wash the dishes as if we were bathing the baby Buddha or the baby Jesus. I mean, how does what you are here to do in serving the world, would you say there's not also this extraordinary back and forth feedback spiritual system? Because as you do this service with mindfulness, it not only gives you greater mindfulness, it's also the universe says, hot dog, we got a live one there. And the synchronicities and the opportunities and the sources and resources begin to come your way.
Absolutely, and let's talk about why that is. The spirit, the universe, whatever words we want to use for all this, works through your own subconscious mind. So when you say, I am doing this project out of love and service, I give my career to love and service, I give this relationship to love and service, I give this whatever I'm involved in to love and service. What this does is it programs the subconscious mind. It programs the subconscious mind to rise to the level where all the stimulus that would block the way becomes hazy and less focused. I become less attached to stimulus that would obstruct me, and I become more aware and more magnetic around possibilities that would serve the project, would serve the possibilities. If I've said I deliver this to love, then there is a greater chance that I will talk to somebody when I just happen to be in the elevator 10 minutes later who has an idea or a relationship or a connection that could help me. Now, they would have been in the elevator anyway, but I would not have noticed them.
That's right.
Things just wouldn't have fallen together in a way that would make the connection. And I think that's important. We're swimming in infinite possibility because
that's the nature of the universe.
So it's not that if I focus my mind on love, the universe brings me things. It's that if I focus my mind on love, I will notice the things that the universe will bring me even if I don't.
Because it's really around you all the time. You know, I study a lot of...
Absolutely. So when we talk about...
I mean, the interdependent co-arising that the Buddhists talk about, that we are really ineluctably part of the universe. We don't just live in the universe. The universe lives in us, so that when we are in love and service, the universe provides, or the ground of being, or God provides the opportunities to serve even more. I mean, I think this is all part of the grand design of what we are here to do, to accomplish our soul's purpose, to lift or shift the human psyche into new understanding or new expression, to ride the fractal wave of possibility and serve the world in the most profound sense of mindful awareness, and believe and keep on visioning. I mean, what is it that enables people to take difficult stands despite all the pressures to stay silent? I mean, they recognize that history turns in unexpected ways, and that getting involved is itself transforming. They create engaged communities, something that you've, you know, been a master at, because very few people can act alone. They recognize that action creates new possibilities, believing in spite of the evidence, and then watching the evidence change. I mean, I think of the heroes and heroines of the past who persevered through bleak times for visions of justice, Rosa Parks, Nelson Mandela, Vaclav Havel, and of course Mahatma Gandhi. They did it by maintaining hope precisely when success seemed most elusive, and they stayed in touch with their codes of possibility, and always, always they were in loving service, as you certainly have been for most of your life, at least as long as I have known you, Marianne. I mean, when people
This isn't just part of the larger design.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just part of the larger design. This is the larger design.
This is the larger design. You're quite right.
The universe is intentional.
Yeah.
Right. The universe is intentional, including the intention that we self-actualize. You know, even when we talk about the universe and us, there is no out there. The Course in Miracles says one day you will realize there is nothing outside you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there's you, and then outside you there's a universe. The Course in Miracles says we are ideas in the mind of God. So the universe is simply doing what it does, which is one loving thought and infinite possibility, followed by another loving thought and infinite possibility, followed by another loving thought and infinite possibility. When we align ourselves with that trajectory of higher power, mind of God, infinite love, whatever you want to call it, when we align ourselves with that through right-minded thinking of infinite love and compassion, we simply ride the train. It's not that something mm-hmm. comes to us, it's that we are part of that and we experience ourselves that way. But free will means we can think whatever we want to think, and when we don't want to ride that train, and we don't choose to ride that train, and it's important to remember, we do make a choice every moment. We make it consciously or unconsciously, but with every thought we think, we either, you know, get a ticket to ride and we ride that trajectory of infinite possibility, or we choose not to. And I think what's important in terms of the work that all of us are doing is that we all cop to the realization that it is a choice. And when you do make that choice of love, and you were talking about the greats and their hope and so forth, you don't do so simply hoping it will turn out well. You do so knowing it will turn out well,
because it's
not over till the happy part. That is the nature of the universe. Love
yes,
will
good.
Always prevail. The
love.
Only question is how long a time it will take.
No, there's that.
And I think that, you know, it's like Susan. I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
It's like Susan B. Anthony. It's like Susan B. Anthony. You know, she did not live to see the passage of the 19th Amendment. You know, what we are all working for may or may not become manifest in our life, even in our lifetimes, the way we might wish. But you work towards something knowing that it is the will of the universe. It's like the line that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the message of all the great religious systems. There was slavery in Egypt for the Israelites, and then there was their deliverance to the promised land. there was the crucifixion, and then there was the resurrection. So all of the great religious and spiritual systems acknowledge the suffering that is endemic to the human condition when we are outside the circle of divine love. But they also acknowledge and deliver to us, to mankind, the message that love prevail, whether you call it enlightenment, promised land, resurrection, self-actualization, or just mental health. It is where we are ultimately moving.
Well, let's talk about this sense of
and
where we're moving
humanity,
to.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. I'll finish what you were saying. I was about to say that
was the beginning of your...
I think we just bowed out for a moment.
We are what, Jean?
Yeah, you can hear me. I was going to say that you are truly a God seed. You are truly the divine essence of love that can be nurtured through practice and through diligence into a fully matured expression of the loving spirit that lives within. I mean, how can we give birth to this miracle within ourselves? How can we foster our natural spiritual presence? You know, I think of the God seed practices, which vary from culture to culture and person to person, be it yoga, prayer, mindfulness, meditation, contemplative prayer, and so many others. I mean, one of the ways I find is to spend more time exploring and celebrating the glories of literature, art, music, dance, theater, or the simple wonders, the phenomenal wonders of the natural world. I find that immersion in beauty, wherever you find it, brings to consciousness the budding of new realities and the freshness of a world made ever new. I mean, the active appreciation of others, of nature, wakes one up to what is going on around you. You spoke about in that state of loving being in the elevator and really seeing people and being able to be available to them. I mean, it heightens empathy. It knits one into a seamless kinship with all living things. And then you begin to appreciate the billion-year story that has gone into the making of this rose, that valley, this ocean breeze, that other person. And it's true, a daily practice is required. And whenever you get caught up in the old, same old, same old, and the old negatives and the old expectations, one has to just stop, and move back in concert with love, with their spiritual partners. I mean, practice miracle management. I mean, you center yourself in your spiritual relationship, and then things happen. You live in the spiritual universe with the great friend that is whatever you call it, God, Spirit, the archetype. And ultimately, as you say, Marianne, it's all about choice and love. I mean, the love that God has for you is not about your history. It's not about anything you've done or not done. It's about your being. It's about who you are. You are, and you say this so much in your work, you are so loved that you are given these enormous energies, potencies. You get to choose what it is in the kingdom of love and in the kingdom of your mind. What you hold in your inner world will become what you experience in your life. Choose love. And this has been a part of your essential teaching, has it not?
Everything that you said. And everybody's. And everything that you just said in describing what we need to do is so right on. The meditation, the prayer, the mindfulness, the yoga, the good eating, the literature, the poetry, and always the atonement, the mercy, the compassion, the forgiveness. I think it's important that we emphasize something that all the great religious systems talk about, and that is the power of the morning. When you wake up in the morning, your mind is most open to new impression. So I know in my own life, if I've meditated in the morning, if I've done my spiritual practice in the morning, if I have consciously and proactively and willingly thought about all the people I'm going to see today, all the things I'm going to do today, and put myself in mindful, loving service, ask God, where would you have me go? What would you have me do? What would you have me say and to whom? Then I am, once again, my subconscious mind is programmed then in
yes.
such a way that I will have a different nervous system that day. I will be centered within a different attitudinal structure within myself. If I do, and that doesn't mean I'm going to be an enlightened master all day, but I know in my own experience it vastly and dramatically diminishes the possibility that I will fall over the cliff. And what do I mean by falling over the cliff? Sending a text, saying something, sending an email, doing something that completely obstructs the flow of love in my life. And so when you said just now, if you get triggered, remember this, if you wait till you get triggered, you're going to have a harder time bringing yourself over back from the cliff.
That's
you know,
true.
We wake up
yes.
in the morning, we take a shower or a bath because we don't want to take yesterday's dirt with us on our body into the day. And it is equally important if you don't want to take yesterday's stress, and not just your stress, but the stress of everybody in Aleppo, this political season and
yes.
all of that. If you don't pray and meditate and really ground yourself in love in the morning, you're going to have a hard time not being at the effect of fear and pathology and neurosis within yourself and others during the rest of the day.
It certainly is true. But however, Marian, how do you address this? Many people have a tendency to believe not only that suffering is good for you, but also that one deserves it. I prefer, because I'm half Sicilian, and my grandmother kept talking about abbondanza, you know. But I believe that the absence of a rich and generous love for life, which might be a synonym for joy, is one of the reasons why so many of us are sick in mind and body and spirit. It's not the only reason, but it certainly is one of them. I mean, the practice of discovering for ourselves the power of joy. We don't eradicate suffering, but we learn to drain some of its poisons quickly. And then we begin to restore ourselves, complete with the required lessons that the suffering has taught us, and come to a keen awareness of the miracle of life. Now, because I know a certain amount that you've shared, not just with me, but also with others, about your times of suffering and transformation, how do you work with that whole fact of having been a heroic woman on the front lines of time and history and all manner of realities, that you've had to face suffering so often, and yet you have, as far as I could tell, you have always come through to even a kind of strange and quirky happiness, joyousness, and celebration?
Well, thank you, Jean. You have been, on a personal level, as well as the level of your greater teaching, very much a factor for me in the angelic voices that have comforted me and lifted me up in the times of my own walking through my own valleys.
Yes.
My latest book is called Tears to Triumph,
yes.
A Spiritual Journey from Suffering to Enlightenment, and it is about just that. I do think that the goal ultimately is the eradication of suffering. I mean, heaven
okay.
is the awareness of our oneness in which there is no suffering. And many of us have had those moments. The issue is we need to make them more than moments. We need to make them hours and days and ultimately the quality of our life experience. In A Course in Miracles, it says, it is not up to you what you learn. It is merely up to you whether you learn through joy or through pain. I said a few minutes ago that the universe is intentional. Your self-actualization is the intention of the universe, and you're going to self-actualize. You're going to learn. And I've seen in my suffering, boy, the things I had to learn. And that's
mm-hmm.
why in the book that I wrote, I had a lot to say about our current society's current pathological resistance to suffering. Because I believe in the concept, the sacred notion of the dark night of the soul. You can't
mm-hmm.
eradicate suffering by avoiding it. You eradicate suffering by dissolving its cause. And the only way to dissolve its cause is to first recognize its cause. And you can't do that if you're numb to your pain. That's why in that book I talk about how do you go through these dark nights of the soul, the times of your suffering, from a place of knowing, yep, this is going to be hard, this is going to be tough, and I'm going to have to look at things that are painful to look at, but only if I do look at them not by desensitizing myself to my suffering, not by avoiding it, not by the various things we do these days to distract. You know, sometimes people will say about the overuse of antidepressants, well, you know, it takes the edge off while people are doing the work. But that's very bogus, because first of all, being with the edge is the work. And second of all, if you take the edge off, you're less attuned to the necessity of doing the work. The work is, what part did I play in this disaster? The work is, who do I need to forgive? The work is, what changes do I need to make in my own life so that this won't happen again? The work is knowing I can easily blame all of this on everybody else, but what was my part? And then, you know, some of them are simply things that were things that we could not in any way have avoided, such as the loss of loved ones. But even on that, and I know you know this one too, Jean, having lost people that we love makes us only more desirous of sucking the juice out of every day that we have with those who remain and with the life that remains. I really agree with what you were saying a few minutes ago about concentrating on the good and loving the good and celebrating on the good. We have become in our society, and I have to tell you, I think our community, the higher consciousness community, is very much a part of this. This almost sick obsession with the sickness.
Yes,
we pathologize everything. We
pathologize instead of mythologizing
it. The wound.
Mm-hmm. And so many.
Oh my God! You celebrate the dawn. You don't just, you know, you have to go through the night, but you don't have to coddle the night. be open to it. But there are seasons of life, and this too shall pass is simply the description of the way nature operates. Winter does turn into spring. And so when you concentrate on Jesus, or you concentrate on Buddha, or you're reading the Bible, or you're reading the great spiritual scriptures, or whatever they are, your mind is literally being infused with the light, i.e. the understanding, that will enable you not only to endure the dark times, but to transform them and ultimately to invoke the greater possibility that lies beyond.
Well, I do believe that we're coded for greatness in many, many ways, but also in America, that there is such a concentration on the dark side. As we both know, you know, if it bleeds, it leads in newspapers and shows. But also, I sometimes think that diagnosis is the psychiatric form of character assassination. How many true geniuses?
That's such a great line. I'm going to quote you on that one. Everybody's got these labels. The anxiety disorder, the depressive disorder. But our civilization has an anxiety disorder because it is dominated by a thought system that is anxiety producing. It's all about us as separate beings and economic competition. That cannot not produce anxiety and depression. And you're right, and it's particularly concerning because it's done so much to young people, Jean. It's kind of heartbreaking. We used to, when you and I were growing up, the labels you went for were things like MA and PhD. Today, the labels are just being slapped around, and mainly for the financial good of pharmaceutical companies, by the way. Are all the various ways
that your
wound of the moment is described with a disorder.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm thinking about some people that I have known who have had extraordinary miracles, one after another, in ways and things happening for them. One of them was Margaret Mead. Did you ever know Margaret Mead? Or she's probably before your time, but Margaret.
I did not know her. I feel I know her through you.
Yes, I was the adopted daughter of Margaret Mead. I have a wonderful mother, and she had a great daughter, but that was our relationship. And I remember I was always astonished at how good fortune followed her all the time. It was just like luck clomping along behind her. And I remember one time we were walking in Central Park, and she is complaining, and she says, I have to find this piece of information. It is critical to the speech I'm going to give tomorrow as the president of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, and I'm lost without it. I'm lost without it. It's got to show up. I can't find it anywhere. And a woman comes up to us and says, Dr. Mead, you don't know me, but I'm Linda Nussdorf, and yes, I know who you are. You were in my class in 1947, and you never finished your paper. And she said, well, Dr. Mead, you're right, but you know, I went on to graduate school, and I wrote my paper on, and then her master's. And it was just what Margaret was talking about. Margaret grabs her by the hand and says, you come home with me. Well, this sort of thing happened all the time. And perhaps one of the most dramatic versions of it was when Margaret and I were working together on various projects, and there was this beautiful, beautiful young man named Alex, who was 24. And I found him just sitting in the corner one day and really suffering. And I said, Alex, what is the matter? He said, oh, Gene, I'm so deeply in love. Well, that's wonderful. Who's a lucky girl? Well, it's not exactly a girl. Well, what do you mean? It's a full woman. Oh, that's wonderful. She's a little older than you? Uh-huh. 5 years? No. 10? No. 20? No. How old, much older than you is she? He's at 50 years. It's Margaret Mead. I'm desperately in love with Margaret Mead. Now, if you remember Margaret, she was no great beauty. She was about 5 feet tall or 4 feet ten, and quite wide, you know, and she had what we would call a very pleasant face. Anyway, so I ran over to Margaret and said, Margaret, do you believe that, do you understand? You know that the beautiful Alex is madly in love with you? And she said, of course he is. Everybody is. How do you explain that? And it was true. And she says, I am bread to them. They are wine to me. But when I kept asking her, why was she so...
I am bread to them. They are wine to me. What a fantastic...
That's funny. Well,
what was the other one you said on this call?
The other one I said in this call?
To me. Oh, my...
Yeah.
You said something else in this call that I went, oh, my God, Gene, I'm going to quote you. I'm going to quote you. I can't remember.
Oh, about, I was talking about diagnosis being the psychiatric form of character assassination.
Yes. Oh, my God.
But when I asked Margaret, why are you so lucky? Why are you so lucky, Margaret? She said, because I expect to be. And she did. She lived in that continuum the universe, that she was in love with the universe and the universe was in love with her. And she was on this nonstop journey of remarkable things. She had only to put a thought out, and things would happen. Our mutual friend, you know, Deepak Chopra is rather like that too, you know. But these are people who would enter. She was contemplative. She was not in prayer. But Deepak, you know, spends a great deal of time in meditation. So he enters into the universe and the treasury house of unseen generosities. That's another phrase of mine.
Yeah,
you can
use. Would probably put synchronistic something in there in his phraseology.
Probably,
also,
yes.
at that level, there is a difference between meditation and prayer.
You know,
at that level, the Course in Miracles says the highest level of prayer is not an entreaty of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at the highest level, they're the same thing.
They are the same. I knew Mother Teresa, you know.
I had an experience many years ago.
Go ahead.
Wow.
Please.
Well, she certainly had some things. I was just going to say, talking
please.
About those things that happen,
mm-hmm.
I have those all the time myself, but one of
yes.
the most dramatic was many years ago, I wrote a book called Healing the Soul of America that was published.
Yes, I remember it very well.
And
I was
when I first
there at the time.
Thank you. It was kind of a prescient book, I have to say, because much of what I said is coming true now. But anyway,
that's
not that
right.
I'm pleased by that. But when I was first starting to write the book, I was pregnant with it in my soul, but I didn't have anything fleshed out intellectually. And I went for inspiration one day to visit Monticello. And I walked because Thomas Jefferson has always been
mm-hmm.
just a guiding force
yes.
for me spiritually, mentally, emotionally. And I went to Monticello, and I was walking in, and I saw this woman. She was a very attractive woman. And I thought, wow, she's so cool. Wow, I'd love to know her about, wow, she's just, there was just something about her, her mystique, her savvy, her elegance, there was just something about her. She was walking alone. And we went into the house, and we were both part of, you know, one of the, you know, the mix of tourists, although at that time there weren't as many, and it wasn't as kind of museum as is today. You could just walk around more. Anyway, I saw her in the house, but, you know, there was no connection. And then I walked away from the house towards where the slave quarters had been, actually. And that woman said, "Excuse me, Miss Williamson." Now, this was my first book had been out for about 6 years, but I didn't get any sense that she knew me when I first saw her. She said, "Excuse me, Miss Williamson." I said, "Hello." And we started talking. And she told me that one of her children was married to Jimmy Goldsmith, who was a very famous billionaire from England, very interesting man, who had written a book called The Trap. And she said, "Do you know about this book?" And I said, "No, I don't." And she said, "Well, I have a copy of it in my car. May I give it to you?" And I said, "Yes." And that book, The Trap, by Jimmy Goldsmith, was the first book I ever read, Jean, that totally laid it out about the way that this behemoth matrix of multinational corporate power was basically taking over the world. It's like when David Corten said, "When corporations rule the world."
Yes, yes.
And that book became absolutely the underlying structure for me intellectually and politically in terms of understanding what was happening and where we needed to go. And I met her in the way I described at Monticello.
Oh, how beautiful.
I think that's
very,
up there with
beautiful.
Your Margaret Mead book.
Yes, so Thomas Jefferson would be very, very pleased. I'm the fifth cousin of Thomas Jefferson, you know, but
oh, and
everybody.
Oh, and by the way,
everybody
many years
is.
Later, many years
yeah.
later,
yeah.
when I ran, many years later, when I ran for Congress myself
yeah.
in 2014, that woman ended up being someone who gave actually a fundraiser. She, by that point, I don't know if she lived in Santa Monica or one
mm-hmm.
of her children did. And when she introduced herself to me at an event for my congressional campaign, she said,
mm-hmm.
"You don't remember me, do you?" And I said, "No." And she reminded me she was that woman.
How wonderful. So it all came around beautifully. Okay, now let's get down and dirty. Let's talk Turkey. We're living in the most challenging time in human history, yes? There is the great phenomenon
yes.
of accelerating.
In American history, for sure.
Yes, but accelerating faster and faster, and most people have not been trained for accelerations. I mean, things that when we used to go to the library for a week or 2 weeks to really track down information or ideas, we can now get in about 20 minutes on the Internet. So we have lost our visceral relationship to things, to data, to information, and that's why these mountebanks and clowns can, you know, take over with their, you know, their tweets and their word, their word monstrosities. Now, given that this history is happening so fast, what we both know, and what you particularly know, about the depths of the relationship to God, to spirit, to love, to choice. Yeah, you're doing something coming up very soon, and perhaps there'll be other versions of it, of Sister Giant. What are you trying to evoke in people so that they can be, in a sense, receive a new order of knowing and even of training to live in a time of so much challenge, so much complexity, a time in which we can go, you know, take a U-turn into the past rather than the emergence of this of a possible society that is always there, but seems we always seem to deviate from it. We're now in the time of the fractal response of awfulness. How, with your knowings that you've gleaned from a lifetime of deep, deep living, what do you have to say about this? What can we do? What do you do?
Well, I believe, largely because of you, Jean, people like yourself, but you being a supreme example, there actually has been an activation among enough minds to form a critical mass that should this critical mass arise to the challenge of the times in which we live, a miracle will occur.
Mm-hmm.
The majorities does not matter as much as we think it does. The majority did not wake up one day and say, "Let's free the slaves." The majority did not wake up one day and say, let's give women suffrage. Societies don't move and improve and heal and transform because of a shift among the majority. The horizontal axis is not where change emerges from. It has to do with a vertical axis. When enough people go deep, enough people, a critical mass of people, align their thinking and ultimately their behavior with what you would, you know, call that emergent possibility, then we invoke it. So to me now, I think what we must guard against is political disengagement, because political disengagement is how we got here. It's not the solution, it's the problem. We must guard against holding on to the rage and the frustration and the whining beyond such time as they are helpful. You know, grief has over the current reality of the election and of Donald Trump, not just the election of Trump, but what he has done since the election.
Yes.
Grief is appropriate. Sadness is appropriate. Rage, perhaps, all of those feelings. But there is a point where processing turns into spewing. There is a point where, if we are not careful, we become self-indulgent. And it's extremely important that at the end of those classic stages of grief, we do not land in acceptance, but we land in inspiration and motivation. And the inspiration and the motivation is for us to go deep, deep inside ourselves, to recognize, as you were an example of someone who helps us do that, what really happened here, not just on the external levels. We know what happened on the external levels, but what happened on the deeper levels? What is the real swamp out of which all this emerged? What are the various things, intellectual understanding, political understanding, emotional understanding, psychological understanding, spiritual understanding, where did this come from? And what part did we individually play? Because for any of us who have not been politically active, we have acquiesced to this. We were part, indirectly, of what brought this about. The citizen is not somebody who's just supposed to observe. And if we were not actively participating in the good, then we were participating in the breakdown. And I think we need to understand this politically as well as on every other level. And then from that, we transform, we take a journey in terms of our own internal being, where we stand attitudinally within ourselves. We stand within a different ground of being. It's like when Einstein said, the problems of the world will not be solved on the level of thinking we were at when we created them. And then we will be able to act, but everything we do is infused with the consciousness with which we do it. So then we will move into action, but we will be acting with, as Martin Luther King would say, cosmic companionship.
Mm-hmm.
So I have felt moved to produce another Sister Giant conference where the first day is people such as yourself, I'm honored to say, who will help us with the deeper levels of understanding. Then the second day, people talking about the external political issues that need to be handled, but we will be approaching them from having been purified and transformed within ourselves, spending a day doing that, so that by the time we approach the external issues, we have decluttered our minds. We will not be carrying with us the rage and the fear, but just carrying with us the inspiration and the motivation, the savvy, the sophistication, and the elegance that is necessary in order for us to work the miracle that's needed now.
Mm-hmm. To work the miracle that is needed now. Let me also put another thought forward and see if you agree or not. Would you say, I was talking about the treasury of unseen generosities that lies there in the universe. There are 300 sextillion stars in our universe. We know that now. And that means there are more stars than there are grains of sand on the planet. There have been probably many experiments and histories, many rises and falls and resurrections. There has been so much knowledge that has been evoked in the development of, we now believe that our cultures and civilizations throughout the universe. So there's something known, and if we are hologrammatic, if we are indeed inseparable with the universe, we have, as you just said or implied, cosmic access. What in Sister Giant, you bring together people in need, in yearning, facing challenges, wanting to find both resolution, not simply in their own lives, but for the life of the society. I personally believe that the answers are there, but we have to go deeply within and together, collectively, begin to tap, have to get into the tap root of all knowing, all knowledge, all love. And that together we can do that, and we can find solutions that hitherto may have seemed impossible or not even valid. I know, Marianne, that in your life you are one of those who leads the way in the, you know, for your own unique mind, style of mind and the Course in Miracles, that you have found ways of tapping into the infinite pools of knowledge and action. How would you suggest that others can do so?
I think every cell in the body is infused with a natural intelligence. And that intelligence guides them. You go to the liver, you go to the pancreas, you go to the lungs, you go to the liver. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true in our lives. You go into the arts, you go into science, you go into education. Where your passion, where your dharma, where your bliss leads you, that's internal direction from spirit. Now, politics is a shared direction. I think that Eisenhower was right when he said politics should be the part-time profession of every American. But at this point, the problems are so multidimensional that each of us has to seek a deeper intellectual understanding. I think one of the most revolutionary things you can do today is read the newspaper. You need to know what is happening. You need to see the appointments that are being made. You know, President-elect Trump is now appointing to cabinet positions people who are sworn enemies of the agencies that they are now asked to lead. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are climate change deniers are being appointed to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. Someone who is against the raising of the minimum wage and whose work can only be seen as anti-labor is now going to be the labor secretary. The person who is going to be heading the energy department is a major fossil fuel guy. So we need to be aware. That is part of one of the principles of nonviolence. I think we then need to go where our hearts lead us. I think Sister Giant is one, as you were saying, of many. But I think for people with a transformational perspective, people who want the transformation and the politics, I think Sister Giant will be a very good thing. And I hope people go to sistergiant.com to find out more. And that will be in Washington, D.C., February 2nd through 4th of next year, just a couple weeks after the inauguration. We got to get in there fast because we need to create a politics of love.
And it will be in Washington, D.C.
That America's a hate. Yes, or live stream. And I don't think that we are a hateful country, but the hate that is here has been recently harnessed for political purposes. And the only way to transcend that is if we now harness love for political purposes. And we simply must get about the task. So we have to understand what's happening. We have to follow what's happening. We have to look to sources like you and me and others who are talking about all of this from a position of progressive spirituality. I think that's an important dimension. And then in terms of the political issues, people are saying what needs to be said. People are proposing what needs to be proposed. As you and I speak, people are talking about the voting from the Electoral College. People are talking about Trump's conflict of interests. You know, this stuff is going on, and there is an awakening happening right now. Unfortunately, it's after the election, but people are waking up. Very smart people are saying very smart things, and if you have an interest in any particular area, you just Google it, because there's some person or some organization talking right now, leading the way. So anybody says, oh, I just don't know what to do, need to get on their computer and look at all the things that we need to do, all the organizations and the groups that are doing it. Nobody has a specific plan of action, which is difficult for us because Americans are good with a to-do list. So each and every one of us has to look at the plethora of data and stimulus and request in our own hearts, dear God, use me. Spirit, use me. I want to be in service of the spirit of democracy. I want to be in service of my country. We need to claim words like patriotism and stop acting like we're too cool for that. and truly put ourselves in service of the enlightened trajectory for our country and our world. And then, just as if you've been saying in this call and throughout your work, and I and others have been seeking to articulate as well, the universe will rise up to us the moment we rise to the occasion of serving the universe.
The poet says, "Thank God, our time is now, when wrong comes up to meet us everywhere, never to leave us till we take the longest stride of soul folk ever took. Affairs are now soul-sized. The enterprise is exploration into God. What are you making for? It takes so many thousand years to wake. But will you wake, for pity's sake?" Marianne Williamson, I've known you for so many years, and you just seem to go deeper and deeper and into the very domain of love, of consciousness, of spirit, and bring us toward a new form of awakening, exploration into God. Thank you, Marianne, for all that you are, for all that you do, for your lifelong leadership. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. There could be no greater honor than for you to say those words to me. I acknowledge you, as I always have, from the deepest part of me. You have always been and continue to be a great guide for me and so many millions of other people. And thank you for your generosity towards me on every level. And I bless you, and on every level, I love you, Jean. Thank you so
love
much.
Love you, Maria. Thank you.